Hi, I'm Josh.
And I'm Lindsay.
And this is the Hideaway Podcast, episode 34.
34.
That's a terrible Dutch. Happy Wednesday morning.
Happy hump day.
That's a little weird. We got a big
weekend. That's what everyone calls it. Get over the hump of a Wednesday.
Yeah. Today, well, not feeling too humpy today. We have a pretty humptastic weekend coming up.
We do. We're working on a workshop. Working on a workshop.
Of a new show that we've been working on with Spencer Novick that we teased a little bit on the podcast last week with Adam Kukler called...
Party Starters.
They get the party started.
Yeah.
And it's a three-person comedy, clown, silly, fun... family-friendly show about these three idiots whose only mission in life is to get parties started and teach other people how to start parties. And the premise of the show is that you're coming in to take their class, basically, and they're going to teach you 20 of the most essential party-starting techniques that you can use in any party-starting situation.
So anyone who is confused or interested... and learning how to start a party. This show's for you.
Yes, it is. And we'll be posting regular sort of behind the scenes stuff to our Instagram feed. What is it called? The thing that you post
live. Oh, Instagram story.
Our Instagram story.
I'm obsessed with Instagram storying, so I'll be posting Instagram stories on our Instagram story.
Yeah, exactly. So check out our Instagram. We'll be posting some fun stuff on there.
On our Instagram story.
On the Instagram story.
We saw the band's visit last week, like we mentioned we were going to see in last podcast.
The musical at Atlantic Theater.
At Atlantic Theater. And let me just set up the audience that was there. It was like the last week of shows that they extended it twice. So I think everyone was like, ooh, I have to go see what this show is. Like, it's doing really well. So we walk in and there's every Broadway producer that has ever been a Broadway producer there in the lobby. And there's this one producer who I interned for like a day and a half before I quit because I thought he was rude to me. And I was like standing up for myself and I felt really empowered that I was like, you know what? I'm not going to let someone treat me like this. Peace out, dude. I did it, of course, in a very professional, polite manner, but I left. But now I feel like he and I have like beef, like we're like the mean girl, like we just have like a thing.
And you saw him in the lobby.
I saw him in the lobby. And every time I see him, I literally wanted like faint. I'm like, ah. But he was there. Jeffrey Seller, who is the producer of Hamilton, was there. Like other people who aren't that interesting. A lot of producers were there. And, but the Stephen Schwartz, who wrote Wicked, was there.
It's funny. It's funny how where you go to, the people who caught your eye were the musical people. I walked in and saw Michael Moore there, and I was like, oh, crap, it's Michael Moore.
Oh, yeah, Michael Moore. And then his
documentary filmmaker.
His guest was Mark Ruffalo. So Michael Moore and Mark Ruffalo were seeing the band's visit together. And so like I was like, wow, everyone is here. And we bought our tickets early, so we had like really great seats. And I think everyone else kind of booked them last minute. So we were sitting like in really nice seats and they were all like behind us. But I was like, wow, everyone's here. And then I went to the bathroom at the end of the show. Who walks out of the bathroom? Danny DeVito. So it was like just to top it all off, Danny DeVito was there.
Yeah. And of course, you know, we were there.
We were there. It was a good show. It's good. It's about this like, takes place in this small desert town in Israel. And this band is playing in this Israel town called, they're supposed to be playing in a town called
Petah Tikva.
But they get confused and they go to
a town called Petah Tikva.
Or the opposite.
Yeah, and there's a song about how one town is with a B and is, you know, fancy and wonderful and full of arts and creativity, and the other one is starts with a P and is like there's nothing in the town that's really boring.
Right.
And that's where they end up.
So it was
funny.
Cute.
The music was really nice.
And the girl who played the lead was just so
she was awesome.
Amazing. But I think it's closed. But I have an inkling it'll reopen somewhere else since all those people were there. And if it does, everyone should definitely go see it.
I think it's going to end up on Broadway.
Yeah, I think so too. I think it needs like a little bit more juice in it as far as like conflict and...
edge.
You know, yeah, edge. But as far as the first time ever doing it off Broadway, it was really good.
Yeah, I agree.
You and I joined... for Christmas, or my mom got me.
What?
Book of the Month Club.
Oh, aren't you an old lady?
I know, but it's so fun. You get to like choose a book that's curated by your peers, basically. And you pick out of the 5 books every month that they recommend, you pick one and they send it to you. And it's a hardcover book. And I'm reading The Woman in Cabin 12 right now.
How's that?
So good. Recommend it as a read.
What's it about?
It's about this. It takes place in England. And it's this woman who is a travel journalist. Mm-hmm. And her boss is pregnant. So she goes on this trip instead of her boss because it's on this luxury yacht that's only 10 cabins for the rich, you know, the richest of the rich, but they're opening up to the travel journalists to write pieces about it. And a murder ensues.
Ooh. Dun, dun, dun.
But it's really well written. It's really good. And I've been seeing it on my Instagram, like people reading it. So I'm reading it. It's very good.
I've actually also recently read a book that we didn't talk about yet, but Spencer Novick suggested I read it a while ago, and I figured in preparation for Party Starters that I would take a
gander. I feel like
gander.
Your vocabulary of words starting with a P has been growing. What yes. did you write on the Party Starter? Prepare to party start and the prepare.
Yeah, I wrote some silly emails to the cast yeah. with a lot of P's in
What's
there.
What's the book, though?
The book is How to Steal Like an Artist, and it's about 100 pages. It's really short. A lot of it is illustrated. But it's a bunch of different ideas on how to generate material and art and ideas and what is the right kind of way to be inspired by other people's work and what is stealing in a not good way. Mm-hmm. And I just had a lot of fun reading it. Like, it got my brain flowing in preparation for this workshop. If you're sort of at a point where you're like, I could use some navigation, some inspiration, this is a really great, easy, quick read, How to Steal Like an Artist.
I don't know what the segue is to Seb, but because he doesn't steal, but he is an artist.
Yeah, there you go. So, segue
to Seb. On this week's podcast, we have your oldest friend.
Yeah, you think he is my oldest friend. Well, he's my oldest friend that I've known him the longest, not that he is particularly old.
Your oldest friend is your grandfather, who's 92.
Yes, that's true.
Oh, little Arnon.
Oh, my grandfather. So, Sebastian, I met him when we were 8 or 9. And I met him in a gymnastics class that we were taking in Stamford, Connecticut. And Sebastian introduced me to seeing Cirque du Soleil after we had met. And that really sparked my interest in this world.
But Seb started in Circus Marcus with you. If you have time and you want a laugh, Google or Facebook search Seb and Josh's Smirkus audition. I watched it. It is... A, very impressive for how old you are at the Korean Plank Act. Very, very good. But B, the artistic idea behind it.
Don't reveal that because we talk about it in the episode.
It's amazing. But so definitely take the time to watch it. But so Seb started in Circus Marcus, then went on to ENC, graduated, worked as a circus artist until he got injured, and then went back to school in Europe to get his master's in
circus dramaturgy,
which we talk about a lot.
Yeah, what is circus dramaturgy? You want to know? Take a listen. But I actually really enjoy talking to Seb. I have a lot of these kinds of conversations with him where he and I will sit up late into the night talking about
debating
different ideas in circus and the merits of things and sort of trying to get down to some core principle truths, which we sometimes manage to and sometimes don't. And we talk a little bit in this episode about his first thesis that he wrote and some of the ideas behind that. What studying circus in an academic environment is like and sort of what a circus dramaturg has to offer the creative process.
I think it's a very interesting episode because we talk about stuff that we haven't yet. And if you have a really strong opinion one way or the other, I think Seb even wants you to email him because I think it's fun for him to talk to people with different ideas.
Yeah, I think this episode's going to challenge a lot of your preconceived notions of what circus is in a good way. So yeah.
I challenged mine. I debate with Seth the whole time. I'm like, no, I don't think so. I don't think so, Seth. But it's fun. Yeah, so have a nice listen, and thanks for following our podcast.
But before you listen, make sure to follow us on Instagram, Twitter, tweet us, Facebook. Write us an email at hello@hideawaycircus.com. And rate us on iTunes. If you like the podcast, if you like what we're doing every week, let us know what you think of it. Leave a comment. We really appreciate it.
Here's Seth. I'm leading the beginning of this interview because you and Josh have known each other since you were
like
11 or maybe even earlier.
Yeah, like single
maybe
digits.
Maybe 9.
Yeah. Did you guys meet in middle school?
We met at gymnastics.
Oh, gymnastics.
Yeah. I convinced Sebastian to come to my middle school.
It's true.
Oh,
it's
wow.
true.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. Because he was like my only friend who wasn't at my school, and I was hating my school, and I was like, maybe I should go to Josh's school.
And then you transferred to Josh's?
I transferred to Josh's school.
And I told Seb at the time that there were like all these cute girls that I was hanging out with, and that my school was just full of cute girls. And then, you know, my cover was blown once Sebastian actually came to the school and
there
saw
were cute girls.
No, but how cool I was around cute girls.
Oh, right.
So you go to his school, you're doing gymnastics together. And at what point do the two of you decide, I'm going to audition for Circus Mercus?
Well, I think the relevant backstory there is that, like, I decided to do gymnastics in order to become a circus artist.
Oh, you had the circus.
I had the whole plan planned
Okay, so let's back up then.
Yeah.
How did you get interested in circus?
Like so many other young circus artists, Cirque du Soleil was my inspiration when I was young.
So you saw Cirque du Soleil way before Josh.
I saw Cirque du Soleil in Hong Kong in 1995, I think.
Casual.
I saw Alegria, and basically I thought it was awesome. I was like so terrified, and then I like couldn't forget it. It was like this traumatic. It was the, like, initial traumatic wound that has, like, created the symptom that is this this life. And basically I had this friend who was just a total, like, you know, you have those friends when you're young and the whole friendship is based on conflict. Maybe that's a boy thing. But no, I've seen my sisters have that also.
No, I think you do. You have the girl that you hate, but you're friends with.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And basically I saw the show, and I don't know if he even saw the show, but he just saw images. And he basically pointed to an image of a contortionist and he was like, you will never be able to do that.
Oh my gosh.
And I was like, that's what I'm doing. That's my life goal now. Watch me.
Watch me. So did you tell your parents you wanted to do gymnastics?
Yeah.
And they knew that you wanted to do gymnastics because you wanted to do circus?
You know, I can't remember what the order was exactly, because I know that when I was young, I was also in kind of like kids' gymnastics classes. Mm. But I know that the seriousness of it came after watching the Cirque du Soleil show and being like, this is what I want to do. And then when I got to the States, the decision to like look for gymnastics, that was really like, I want to be a circus artist and how do I do this? You know.
And how old were you?
It was 98 when we moved back. So I guess I was 7 years old.
I think we met in fourth grade. I think that's
no,
sure.
I think it was earlier. I think it was like third
grade.
Because when I came back, my first year was second grade.
Yeah,
and I went to gymnastics almost immediately.
Yeah,
but so back to you at 7 doing gymnastics with Josh.
I want you to recount how you discovered Circus Mercus online. That story.
So I was searching for circus summer camps because my mom was like, "They do this thing here that's called summer camp. You should do one." And I was like, okay, I'm going to Google circus. And I found Circus Mercus online and I was like, this looks freaking amazing. Like, this looks awesome. And it was sort of late at night and I like ran into my parents' bedroom and my mom was in the bathtub and I like ran into her bathroom and I was like, Mom, I found this awesome thing. And I like, I think I had printed out the homepage because it was like the early 2000s. I like printed out the homepage of the website. And I handed it to her in the bath, and she said, oh, I'm not sure. And I was like, come on, Mom, please, please. And she was like, what if they sell you into slavery?
You're like, at least Josh and I will go together.
Yeah. No, but at that point I was on my own and I went the first summer by myself. And then the next summer I was like, camp. Josh, you have to come with me to this thing. It's awesome.
Okay. So you first went to the camp.
Yeah.
And how was that like life changing?
Yeah, totally. It was also like a totally different social crowd than I was experiencing in my elementary school, you know?
Right. Really? I found my people.
Yeah. And that was cool. And not even, I found my people, but just to see that there was an alternative and that the idea of like what a, you know, you have one social life when you're a kid and you feel like that's the world.
Mm-hmm.
And then getting outside of that, you see something else and it's quite,
right.
Yeah, it was really like refreshing and eye-opening, totally.
What did you study when you were at camp? Or do you study everything at
camp? You kind of do everything. I mean, mostly into Ariel, but also other stuff. Like, I mean, it was like this new discovery thing. So I was trying everything. Mm-hmm. I was into everything. And even through Smirkus, I kind of did a little bit of everything.
Mm-hmm. I know. Sorry, I'm just imagining you guys in your Smirkus costumes. Like, in those, like, doctor jackets and, like, or what?
Yeah, me and Josh had this legendary, for all you audience members out there, or listeners, for all the listeners out there.
All the listeners.
Josh and I had this legendarily embarrassing audition.
Well, that's what I'm imagining, fantastic. Too. The audition tape is really incredible. Yeah, it's
still on YouTube somewhere. Those of you should go dig that up. Type in Sebastian and Josh Smirkus audition into YouTube.
We should just put the link of it into the...
Oh, I'm not going to make it that easy.
It's so funny. Oh my God. It's really just magical. So you come back and you're like, Josh, we need to do this.
Also, because we were at we were going to this gymnastics summer camp also, and it was a totally different vibe. It was really kind of like competitive and kind of like macho, but in this like sort of... boarding school-y kind of way.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
It was a little bit like, yeah, it was a little bit not cool. And Smirkus was a totally different vibe, like way more family loving. Mm-hmm. Like, yeah. So I was like, you've got to come do this. And we did.
But I would like you to describe your audition tape and how you came up with it.
Not dissimilar from the way we do the podcast. I think Seb and I like set up the camera. And then, like, riffed, like,
yeah, a well, whole we bunch were, of times. We were, like, training kind of, like, hand-to-hand.
Yeah.
I know.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, this is
so amazing.
I think what we cut out, there's a video, Seven, I also made, like, a trampoline tricks video that oh we did God, in his yeah. backyard that I don't think made.
Because we did duo trampoline in the Smirkus show yeah. for, like, 2 years in a row or something. Yeah.
We did things that fit my body type well and not Sebastian's body type.
I was like, whatever, I'm along for the ride, you know?
Yeah, this like long, gangly, flexible body.
I didn't get it at all that was not my thing. I was like, I could do anything.
Did you guys, what did you hang in your garage?
Well, prior to hanging stuff in my garage, Seb took the initiative to like build a trapeze bar, a more legit trapeze bar on his swing set. And yes. He built a wire in his backyard with cinder blocks.
That's true. Yeah. The more advanced trapeze, let's be clear, only entailed, like, we had a swing set that had already on it a trapeze, but it was, like...
I like one of those with the little...
It's like a trapeze triangles. For kids with the triangle, yeah. plastic triangle handles, and, like, the bar was, like, metal and slippery, and it had chains, you know? Right. And making it more professional only involved wrapping the bar in tape. But I was training like legit trapeze on chains for a while because I was like, whatever pain, you don't bother me.
Who needs that pain?
It was like really intense. Like there's photos of me doing like, I don't know if you can picture what a gazelle roll up is, but that shit is painful even on ropes. And I was doing that on chains, just like, whatever. I love circus.
So you guys go to camp for the first time together.
Yes. Yeah, we do camp. Seb does it for 4 years. I do it for 3 years, right? Do I have that right?
Maybe even more, but who's counting?
So you did 3 or 4 years of camp before you guys auditioned for the tour.
Yeah.
And what did you audition for the tour?
With hand to hand.
With the two of you?
Yeah.
I did not know that. Yeah. I thought you auditioned trapeze and something.
No. We auditioned, I mean, it was not exactly hand to hand. It was kind of like dynamic partner acrobatics. What they call eccentric acrobatics.
But I believe though it was, we wore zoot suit costumes, but
yellow.
We had.
Which we ordered online from a Halloween costume store.
We did, but we had made the act. The act was directed originally by Jesse Dryden. As me and Sebastian as janitors. Yes. And we had
we didn't think about how problematic that was to be just kind of like whatever, we're kind of like manual laborers, right. You know, it's kind of weird when you think about it. No.
But also, we're janitors. We're really happy
about our job because capitalism, whatever, you know.
But we had plungers that we used in the janitor act where like we would do stuff for like Seb and I would like use the bar of the plunger in order to like pull some over my back, or you know, like we would use it as a device to get a trick. But then when we zoot suit caper 1920s themed it, I don't remember how we
became an umbrella. No,
oh, just,
I think it was an umbrella.
Oh, okay.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah.
That's a good memory. I was going to say we used a broom or something,
I think it was an umbrella.
In the second year, we auditioned with what is actually, I think, our most legendary
Korean plank.
Number, Korean plank.
With this, like, surreal Korean plank thing where I was blue and you were red.
Yes.
Or, I was, like, the blue guy and you were the red guy and we were wearing these outfits, these, like, tight kind of, sort of, like, 70s looking kind of like outfits with silver shorts and like swim caps, and we had painted like the top halves of our faces the color of our outfits.
And we're wearing tights.
And we're wearing tights. No. And have you never seen this?
And no, I've never.
There's still a video somewhere.
I'm crying.
And the music was Whip It by Devo.
Yeah.
And I like legendarily fucked up the last trick, but like super. Remember? I like,
oh, yeah.
The last trick was like a front tuck off the board. And I just, like, was, like, nervous and excited that it had been going so well. I was like, oh, my God, Smirkus auditions. And, like, I just let my legs, like, collapse.
Buckle.
Like my knees into my butt. But then we got up and did it right, no?
Yes.
Yeah.
Here we did the
track. I remember that being a big hit that year. And then our final year, Seb did. We auditioned 3 to 3 years together on tour. And the third year is when we auditioned separately, and yeah. I was like, oh fuck, Seb already is good at something and I gotta learn something.
What did you do, so
I can do a solo audition.
I did a hoop.
Oh, hoop.
I did a hoop, and that's when the setting up the legit aerial rig in his garage
happened.
Okay.
And by legit, all we mean is that, like, it was hung from a regular height. We still used, I believe, a literal mattress as the as the crash pad.
Yeah.
What did you audition with? For
straps.
Straps.
Yeah.
Okay. Oh my gosh. So the first year you guys did tour together, what was the theme?
Zoot Suit Caper.
So you guys were perfect.
Yeah, I mean, well, we themed, of course, because you get the theme before the audition. Yeah, and then you make the number to suit
clever.
The theme. Except the last year I was like, whatever. But last year I was like, I'm exploring myself this year.
on hoop.
On hoop.
But I wonder if you could talk about a little bit of like the internal struggle you had during sort of junior, senior year as you're going to like an incredibly academic private high school where...
I mean, I wouldn't call that an internal struggle. That was full on a struggle with external forces.
But, you know, you had to choose between... But you were accepted at Columbia and going to circus school is not an easy choice to make.
Yeah, I mean, my parents were the most chill about it, I think. I think a lot of my friends at school were confused because the atmosphere at school was really ambitious. And I think no one understood what circus school was going to be. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I never got outright like, you're wasting your life comments, but like people didn't understand. But I never really felt so, you know, like when I got into circus school, I didn't think twice about going. I did think twice about doing more than 1 year. I was like, I'm definitely going to do 1 year of this and then we're going to see where it goes. But within 3 months, I mean, the atmosphere at ENC is so compellingly internal in a way.
Yeah, insular.
Yeah, I just got so involved with that scene that I was like, there's no way I'm giving this up. Like, I wanted to do my preuve synthèse and like, that was going to be the highlight of my life, you know?
That's your final presentation.
Yeah, the final presentation.
You auditioned for ENC doing hoop?
Yeah, doing the same number as I auditioned for Smirkus with that year.
Must have been a good number.
I think it was okay, yeah. it's like obviously super embarrassing, but like
also, you had a few good tricks in there that you didn't keep.
I brought some of those back. Yeah. Like the
toes to knees.
The toes to knees thing that we trained together. Yeah. I ended up bringing that back later on.
Toes to knees.
Like toes on the top bar and then fall to knees on the bottom bar.
Oh, Leah Hinz
does
just
that
was,
trick.
Yeah, I like that trick.
Yeah,
that's a good trick.
So you graduate ENC, you move to Europe. Could you talk about sort of what that experience was like being sort of raised in an American and then Canadian system and then all of a sudden seeing what the European version of the circus world was like?
Yeah. Well, my first step was going to London. And I was working in London, Brett Pfister basically offered to introduce me to the scene, which was like super awesome of him because otherwise I wouldn't be where I am today totally. Because I was kind of just sitting in Montreal, like, when is somebody going to hire me? You know, like waiting for it to drop from the sky. And
that's why Seth Breakfaster also interests you, because you guys have very similar acts.
Yeah, I mean, he totally inspired me to do Hoop, yeah. for sure. Yeah. But so I went to London and I found the scene there really difficult, in that I found that I had to do 3 times as much networking, schmoozing, and partying as working. And also that what I was surprised about was the things that I thought were exciting innovations in terms of number composition. I think the people programming the shows there saw as sort of just weird, you know, which I totally understand now. And it's exactly when I was working at the Box and I was like, Josh, what do you think about this number? And you were like, you need to change that music. And I was like, no, but it's new and different. And I didn't understand that actually often in the cabaret world, in the commercial world, like you need something that works and sells. And I was not always, I was right after school and during school, I think somewhere in a strange middle ground between wanting to make something exciting and compelling, but also feeling like I wanted to push the boundaries sometimes in ways that made things alienating or something, you know?
Yeah.
So I moved to London and found that sort of hard, and started meeting contemporary circus artists. And at a certain point, what happened? At a certain point, I started feeling more like I wanted to train dance. So I was looking for places to do dance workshops, and also my rent was too expensive in London. So so I decided to go for a month to Brussels, and I started meeting people in that scene, and I felt immediately more at home there.
And at some point, after you've been in Europe for like a year, you injured yourself, right?
Yeah.
Can you talk about what that was like, sort of having to deal with going, oh, damn it, now I'm out for X amount of time, and what that does to your psyche?
Yeah, totally. I mean, as a circus artist, when I was really focusing on performing, I was always paranoid that I was going to be injured and not be able to continue, even for a small amount of time. Because when you're in the middle of a contract, if you get injured, it really sucks to have to be like, sorry, I'm out of here, you know?
And what were you doing when you were injured?
GOP.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Which is like a sort of a variety cabaret circuit.
Yeah, it's kind of like a chain of cabarets, and it's a good gig because if you get hired by them, they sort of shuttle you between their different venues, and it's, you can do it for years, kind of. So it was sort of like, that was really my first year where things were rolling, you know, and I had done a bunch of contracts in a row, kind of, and I wasn't necessarily being super, super good about like training because I was doing a lot of shows, and I was like, this is kind of enough. Although, honestly, I was still training a lot. You know, I'd do like an hour and a half warm-up, which I never do anymore, you know? Do like an hour and a half warm-up, and like part of that was always like physio and stuff, so whatever. I don't think I was totally to blame. I think I was partially just...
Unlucky.
But I did a trick where I like dislocated my shoulder.
During a show,
yeah.
Oh. Which, what did you do? Did you...
I sort of thought, because sometimes things just kind of pop around. Like, sometimes you just do a thing that hurts, and you're like, whatever, I'm just going to continue. Like, you know?
It's such a circus thing, because I'm like, oh, that hurt. I'm not doing that ever again.
Yeah. But circus hurts, and sometimes it's hard to distinguish what's a damage hurting and what's normal hurting. And whatever. It was, like, the first move of my number, and I was on adrenaline, so I just... And it was a thing where, like, one trick popped it out and the next trick popped it back in. So I was like, okay, well, this is fine. Now it's in. But then afterwards, it really hurt and it kept on hurting and getting worse. And it's, like, really scary because you're like, what the hell am I going to do if this is a real problem? And it ended up being a real problem. But it was funny when I went back to Brussels I went back to Brussels and I knew that I was going to have to stay in Brussels. Like, I had quit GOP. And... By the way, they flew in a replacement within like 24 hours, which is crazy. So circus artists out there, don't feel bad about like if you're injured, just like they don't mind. Like they'll get a new person. Like
we will find someone.
They'll find someone quick.
Did you need surgery? You did need surgery,
I did need surgery, yeah. So I was lucky that I was in touch with the physio at ESAC, the circus school in Brussels, and he got me into the operation super quick. So I was like one, I only had to wait for a month or something. And I got the surgery, which was a slap lesion repair. So it was like repairing the labrum, the round ligament.
In your shoulder.
In my shoulder.
That's what said.
Yeah, sorry, I was pointing at my shoulder. and I was like super relieved to not be doing GOP. I was kind of like happy to be home. And then I was like, shit, maybe I should reevaluate some life choices. Because I was stoked that my contract was finished after. I was like super happy. I was like, thank God I don't have to do this.
Right, and I was like, well, I should be rethinking
this. I should be rethinking some life decisions because like something is not going right if this is... And while I was injured, of course there was a period where I was like, what the fuck am I going to do? Because I couldn't even really work a day job because I had an arm in a sling. You know, I couldn't be like, oh, I'm just going to work in a bar until this is done because I couldn't carry anything.
Right.
You know, I couldn't even wash my own dishes, let alone other people's. You know? And so I wrote to Angelique Wilkie, who's now teaching at Concordia in the dance program. And she was at the time, I don't know what exactly her position was at ESAC, but she was involved with the artistic direction at ESAC in Brussels. And my boyfriend at the time was getting ready to do Cirque du Dumas. And she was sort of coaching his number, Hugo Mega. And I met her through that and we got along super well. And so when I was trying to decide what to do with my time, I wrote to her and I was like, do you have any projects you're working on? Can I just come and observe your process? And it turned out that she was sort of leading the creation of the first year show at ESAC that year. So she brought me in at first as an observer and then really like was super generous about letting me contribute a lot to the artistic process. And like, I really got to see what she did when she wasn't with the students. Also like the way that her planning worked and the way that her reflection worked outside of the studio. And I found myself so much more happy doing that than performing GOP. And I was like, well, maybe this is what I should be doing, you know?
Which led to sort of what you're doing now, which is that you've finished 1 year of one grad program sort of focused on dramaturgy with you specializing in circus dramaturgy, and now you're in your another separate program, but a second year studying.
Yeah, it's kind of confusing. Yeah. So I'm at Utrecht University in the Netherlands. And in the Netherlands, they have two different tiers of master's program. And basically, I did the less serious tier, and now I'm doing the more serious tier. And
studying dramaturgy.
The official name of the program was Theater Studies, and now it's this year they changed the name to Contemporary Dance, Theater, and Dramaturgy. But it's the same syllabus, basically.
Can you talk about what discussing circus and dance like in academia is like, and the kinds of things you talk about, and just the approach to what it is for somebody who knows literally nothing about talking about that kind of stuff in an academic environment?
Yeah, sure. The thing that struck me most when I first got into university was that, and I think this is maybe unique to also the Dutch ethos. I'm not sure. But when we went to go see shows as a class, the professors were quite adamant that rather than criticizing and saying what it could have been, that we sort of assume that everything that was what it was supposed to be,
mm-hmm.
and that our thought process be more about what that does, you know? So, like, if the easiest example is if a show is super, super boring, then rather than saying, oh, well, they fucked up, like, mm-hmm. that was boring, they really encouraged us to think, well, that artist made a boring show. Why would they have wanted to make a boring show? Like, what does being bored do to the spectator, et cetera, et cetera?
Mm-hmm.
So there's really a much more affirmative approach. And I realized that, because in circus school and among circus artists, like, often we go to shows and it's just, you just trash it afterwards.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least in Europe and in Canada. Sorry, Quebec. and it was so refreshing to be like, oh yeah, actually, like, anything is like okay. Like, who am I to say what a show should be or shouldn't be?
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that you and I were talking about last night was sort of the circus industry in general's pushback wouldn't be the right word, but I mean, the woman we talked about, I'm going to mispronounce her name, but
anti-intellectualism?
Yeah, anti-intellectualism. Yeah. Well, maybe not anti-intellectualism, but anti the... Yeah, I guess intellectualism is the right word. It seems more academically bent anti than it seems just purely intellectual. Like, there seems to
well,
be
why
some...
Well, why do you think that is? I'm going to interview
Wait,
you
but
for a
you
moment.
You guys had just this
Did we not ask the question
No, I have
properly.
No idea what you're talking about.
Okay. So we had a conversation about Bauke Lievens, who's a Flemish dramaturg.
Who... Lindsay and I talked about her open letter... 2 or 3 podcasts ago to do with romanticism and
yeah,
circus.
So she's been writing these open letters mm-hmm. and they've been quite controversial in the circus world because mm-hmm. her writing style is difficult.
Yes. What essentially we talked about was sort of how the audience, Lindsay talked about the podcast a couple episodes ago, and you can go back and listen to it, but how the audience that who most benefit by it, is not the kind of audience that's well served by a super academic writing style that she writes in, which is unfortunate because that's who can really have that long extended conversation with her. Yeah, let's talk about that I guess anti-intellectualism is one way to frame it, but I think I'm not really sure what the root of it is, but have you experienced that personally?
Oh, sure, totally. I mean, because also the place that I'm at, like, because I'm trying to discover things for myself, I'm not necessarily concerned in my writing at the moment about making it accessible. Mm-hmm. And I actually think that the stuff that I'm producing at the moment within the university is even less inviting than Bauke's writing. I was lucky enough to be able to give a couple lectures. But so in at the Circus Festival in Berlin, at the Barcelona Hand-to-Hand Conference, and at Tent in Amsterdam, which is a residency center. In all cases, I could see that some people really connected with what I was going on about, and some people were like, this is not for me.
What were you typically presenting?
I was kind of presenting different versions of my thesis research, which we can talk about more in depth.
Well, let's talk about that just
quickly.
Just quickly, just so people get a sense of what, what okay. it is that's putting people's backs up.
Yeah. So my thesis was called Taking Back the Technical Circus Dramaturgy Beyond the Logic of Mimesis.
Boom.
Boom.
Wait, oh my God, you're going to have to say this like 3 more times so I can retain it. What?
So, Taking Back the Technical.
Taking Back the Technical.
Circus Dramaturgy Beyond the Logic of Mimesis.
What does mimesis mean?
Mimesis is the imitation of action. So, like, acting is mimesis.
So, what? So it's like, taking back
the... Mimesis means imitation.
So, you want to take back the technical from... Okay, I don't even understand your title, Seb. And I, like, went to Columbia. I'm not...
So the premise of it is that I kind of saw this trend in circus discourse, and not necessarily... Well, in circus shows, but also in the way circus artists talk about circus, in which the technique is different from the meaning of the show. You know?
Like, give an example of that.
Like slumber is an example. So, like, in slumber, the meaning of the show or the story
mm-hmm.
doesn't have to do with the individual tricks. Would you agree?
Okay.
Like,
yes,
the story is, like, these, like, girls, they have this night out. There's am I allowed to spoil it?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
There's like, murders, or, you know?
Yeah.
So, like, so that is different from...
Right, and this drop on silk doesn't...
Yeah, it doesn't necessarily... Within the context of what the show is quote-unquote about,
yeah.
the specific tricks are kind of not irrelevant, but they're like a little bit decoration.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not a criticism of your show.
No.
This is just...
Like, I'm super offended. No, I mean, it would be crazy if I was like, well, actually, that drop on Chinese pole...
Yeah.
was really
meaningful.
There is one... I think there was one drop in Chinese pole, actually, that did really mean a lot for the story.
Yeah, there are moments where the tricks serve the story, but overall, you're right. Like,
yeah,
but he's doing roles, four roles
yeah.
versus roles of the pike.
It's like,
versus,
okay, what are your tricks?
The structure of the show is not built on the tricks.
Right.
The structure is built on different things.
Yes, totally.
Yeah.
I totally agree.
And so my question was, so if we're always using, like, theater and dance more as the carriers of meaning,
mm-hmm.
and the circus tricks are sort of decoration, then, like, why are we doing circus at all and not
mm-hmm.
just theater or dance?
Mm-hmm.
Not in the context of a commercial show where, like, obviously the the tricks add excitement. Like, there's obviously a reason for it. But more when circus artists are claiming to be artists with a capital A, like making work that has that's not about entertainment, but that's about, you know, some whatever, something else. Mm-hmm. I just had a question of the medium. Mm-hmm. It's like a circus trick is not neutral, and I find that often circus artists treat circus as if it can just convey anything, and that the material itself, but for me the material itself already has certain meaningful qualities.
What do you think circus is good at conveying, or versus or is bad at conveying for sort of this?
Well, I think what it's particularly bad at conveying is like narratives about humans. Mm-hmm. Because like any circus trick only very, very generally can refer to like ascent or like, mm-hmm. like disaster. Like it's not very articulate. Mm-hmm. Like circus technique is not very articulate if you try to map it back onto kind of like the sort of story that would happen in a play.
Right. Well, you know? Josh and I always talk about how I think circus is really good at evoking emotions and feelings of things and like themes, but not necessarily detail.
Yeah. And that's what I was looking into, was different kinds of ways that circus creates feelings. Mm-hmm. Like at the most basic level. But I think the distinction that I made was feelings. I didn't even want to go so far as saying emotions. I wanted to talk about what is called affect. So it's like feelings outside of like sad, happy, which are already these categories that refer back to words. Mm-hmm. So like these sort of like feelings that you can't even necessarily talk about. I wanted to investigate different parameters that circus technique.
Well, I think like we talked about on our podcast before, and Adam was just on our previous podcast, but watching Adam's hat juggling act.
Adam Kugler.
I don't know what the feeling that I was feeling was, but when I was watching it, I was feeling something.
Yeah.
You know, and like that was, I've said this now a million times, so apologize, but that was the first act where I was like, wow, I'm actually connecting to this in a way that's like, I'm not supposed to be like, I'm like, oh, I understand like this girl is sad or like this is angry or whatever. And I was like, oh man, this is making me think and feel, and like, it's really telling me a story. And it was the first time I had seen it like in a real effective way.
But I guess that sort of brings up an interesting question is like, through this like research, did you find of like the relevance of story as a thing within circus? Like,
yeah, I think I was trying to talk on a level pre-story.
Yeah.
I was really thinking of composition as like organizing different kinds of like energies in space. Mm-hmm. So like there's kind of like an intense energy over here, or like a more relaxed energy over there. And basically through trying to come up with different kinds of categories for talking about these sort of more abstract energies, I was trying to make that a legitimate way of thinking or talking about circus. Because at the moment I find, I mean, especially in Europe where we have to write funding applications, so you have to explain a lot of what your show is about. I hear a lot of people saying, oh, this is putting me in a box. Like, I don't really want to have to do this. And the writing of the funding application is a pain in the ass because the motivation is not telling a story. The motivation is kind of the technical research or but there doesn't exist the language yet in the community for describing that in a way that sounds compelling. Like to say that what I'm going to show is kind of like a formal arrangement of trapeze tricks. Like most circus artists don't yet have the vocabulary to explain the kind of content that they already are creating just in their practice.
Or the value of it.
Or the value, yeah, exactly, the value of it. Or why people would want to support that kind of research.
So what happened, you know, you're presenting this to people who are in the circus community, how do they react to it?
Like, everywhere was a little bit different. In Amsterdam, I had the longest time with the circus artists that were there. Like, we were doing a two-day workshop and the lectures were part of it. So they were more close to me and I felt like they felt more comfortable expressing dissent, you know? That other people just, like, walked into this space and I was, like, saying this crazy shit. And I feel like even if they had felt super offended, they wouldn't have talked to me.
So what was the biggest offense to them?
Was this idea that circus technique is not neutral. Because it sort of is an offense to your artistic autonomy or something. Your ability to decide, you know? So they were saying
that it's not neutral? Because, like, do you mean, like, a trick, you watch a trick and just by doing that trick, it's already something?
Yeah.
Okay. So it's not just like, but I don't know if I don't know if I agree with you. Now that I'm actually thinking about it. Because, I mean, if you watch, like, so can you give me an example of a trick on hoop?
Yeah.
That you would say is not. So
like, I don't think any of them are neutral.
But I know that. Yeah. Like, so I get that. Yeah. So say, okay, so like your toe to the knee drop. Yeah. What does that then evoke? Or like
it evokes itself. So it just is what it is. And when you see it, you get a certain feeling from it. And that's the level that I'm talking about.
Okay.
So that's why it's beyond the logic of mimesis. So it's not about referring to something outside of itself.
Yep.
But it's about designing within just what it is.
It's funny. I think you're actually coming at it from a very jugglery almost perspective. Like, I think the people who are the most into that way of thinking about technique, I think, are often jugglers.
Yeah, I think that I have a lot in common with jugglers.
Because they sort of go like, yeah, the trick is not supposed to be like to tell a story or anything. It's just your reaction to the way in which this pattern looks and the way in which I'm accomplishing it and the thing I'm presenting is just the trick itself.
Yeah, I think I'm really reacting to that feeling. The feeling that I had when I was in circus school, that my technical research was itself important.
Yeah.
You know, I was like, that's my real work. And I think what I didn't think enough about in school was how to stage that in a way that the research or the knowledge that I'm generating becomes clearly what the performance is about. Like, I felt like I was often hiding behind character.
Mm-hmm.
And in a way,
don't you think like some of the, I don't know. I don't know. I mean, like, I'm coming at from it from, like, a dance point of view more. Like, mm-hmm. I don't know. I had this whole, you know, repertoire of moves, right?
Mm-hmm.
And it's, like, similar to the tricks. And you can string them together in a way that will either evoke this or this. But, like, at the base of it all is, like, all this, what I would say is neutral vocabulary that you can then take and make into different things.
Well, you could look at ballet, for example, as an example of... Okay, let's look at ballet for a second. So ballet, yeah, sure, it can be strung together into a bunch of different stories, all of the different stories of the ballet repertoire. But the technique itself has certain content in the sense that it values, like, weightlessness, both in the sense of, like, the kinds of bodies that can be ballerinas and also the movement vocabulary. It's all about the illusion of flying, essentially. So it's sort of, it expresses this idea that, like, grounded, earthy, also, like, sexuality is kind of taboo in ballet.
Definitely in classical ballet.
It becomes very formal in a sense that's not connected at all with, like, your hip region. Like, there's this whole frozen... In ballet, there's a word, it's like the frozen foot or something. There's a section of a ballerina's body that, like, never...
No.
It's, like, between the bottom of your ribs and, like, the top of your thighs.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it kind of... You don't at all move from your hips, you know?
Yeah, I mean, in a very, like, specific classical... Yeah.
And then also, like, turnout is about being super visible. Like, mm-hmm. So you're always performing for a frontal spectator, and the point of turnout is like visibilizing as much of your body as, like, opening yourself to them. You know, you do an arabesque and you open your chest to the... It's all about being kind of like splayed open,
mm-hmm.
And the bodies are super disciplined. So mm-hmm. like ballet is like, in a way, pro weightlessness, anti earth, anti sexuality, like. Pro visibility, yeah.
I mean,
pro surveillance.
Like, very like. I can think of ballet moves that would contradict a little bit of what you're saying.
Mm.
You know, but I guess I do see your point.
Yeah, but in general, if you're a ballerina and you land heavy, that's bad.
Yeah, but there's a lot of pliés where you're going down and you're like going into the ground, right? And you're pushing off from the ground. Like I would say, and like, you know, even when you are in a turn and your arms are in first position or whatever, you're like, that's like guarding yourself, right? And that's like bringing it in. And I, and like, there is a lot of, there is sexuality when it's like the man and woman dancing together, right? He's like lifting her and it's all like holding her hips while she's spinning.
Yeah.
And like the legs and stuff. And like, I don't know. When I watch ballet, sometimes I do feel like it's very sensual when it's like a man and woman partnering dance.
Mm-hmm.
And even some of the like, you know, like when you like all this like arm stuff and like, I don't know. I totally see what you're saying, but I also don't.
I think it's, I think the, it's at least to me, the juggling example is the one that's like the clearest for me to wrap my, my brain around. But I think it comes from an interesting point of finding the artistic relevance in pushing simply physical movement in new ways without having any narrative component, narrative or at least thematically narrative, like it's about sadness, like you were saying, or about happiness. And I definitely think circus performers struggle with a way to prove that, like, particularly jugglers, like, yeah, this new seven ball pattern I found out is not just athletically impressive, there's also an artistic element to it. Like, this is visually, aesthetically, you know, interesting looking.
Yeah, and I find we get in a position where it becomes hard to justify putting tricks in. In a really artistic context, it becomes hard to justify putting tricks in.
Yeah.
And I think that means that we're thinking about we're thinking about the content of shows wrong, because our medium are these tricks. Our medium is these tricks.
Mm-hmm.
So I think what I was trying to do also in my research is start from the technique and see what you can build from the technique without it becoming second fiddle to narrative, like a more literary or a more like dramatic way of making meaning.
One of the things that I thought was really kind of fun and funny that we were talking about this morning is how essentially a lot of the discussion and a lot of things you've been learning and exploring while you're in university are best suited for a university setting and also best suited for people who are studying circus, but maybe not best suited for people who are doing a bachelor's in circus.
Yeah,
Can you talk about why you sort of think that?
Yeah, because I'm encouraging people to be unpopular, you know, kind of like the kinds of things that I'm going to throw in there and ask people to question are the things that are precisely selling their numbers.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it's confusing because circus school, on the one hand, tells you you're an artist, and on the other hand, often is really focused on creating numbers that then can be sold on the market as like a commercial product. And the kinds of questioning that I'm involved in at the moment is not necessary. In fact, if you listen to me at all, you're not going to make a number that sells. So I feel kind of irresponsible going into a bachelor's program and being like, but like, why don't you make an hour long number? Or like, right. Why don't you make a series of 30-second long numbers?
I think
or
this
something,
is where you and know? I are having not trouble connecting. That's not the. But
are
like,
we having trouble connecting? Because
no.
I feel so connected to you right now.
In life, we're super connected on this very thought process. We're not.
Yeah.
But I think. But I understand what you're saying. But I think that's what my problem is, because I'm coming from it with such a. Unfortunately, like a commercial.
It's not unfortunate. I think that what's unfortunate is that we've established that hierarchy where artistic is cooler or something. You know?
I don't think that. I definitely think that commercial can be really cool too.
I also do.
In the unfortunate way of like you doing an hour long piece just can't make money.
Yes.
You know, and like unfortunately for my brain, I have to come at it from a, will this be a financial success or not, right?
Totally.
And so from my point of view, I'm like, well, exploring these things, like, it just, like, it's so hard for me to understand, because I'm just like, well, why? Because it's not gonna do anything as far as, like, you know, who's gonna come see that? Like, who's gonna pay money to see
it? I'm more responding to the claim that circus is an art form in the same arena as contemporary dance, theater, visual arts.
Right.
This kind of stuff. And
which are also still hard for people to come see.
Yeah, totally.
But they're very valid, and I really appreciate all of those.
But there's, I think, a certain confusion in the circus world that we're both at the same time.
Mm.
And I think that prevents us from being taken seriously by anyone sometimes.
Yeah.
So I'm not at all saying that commercial circus needs to or should or would benefit from a more in-depth, formal self-knowledge. Like, obviously, commercial circus develops along the lines of what's exciting. And that's totally chill and great and exciting. But there's a lot of circus artists that talk a lot of shit about art, you know, and you go to a circus show and they say, well, that sucked for this and this and this reason. And like, what was the justification behind that trick? And like, what, I didn't get what the point was. And that talking that talk is not so far as I have seen coupled with walking that walk. And that's more what I'm mm-hmm. engaged with.
Mm-hmm.
Does that make sense?
Yes.
Well, I feel like we've covered so much and that we could do this for 2 hours, but I do want to get you to answer our classic.
Oh yeah. Okay.
Our classic questions.
Classics.
So the first classic question is, has there been a piece of advice other than all the pieces of advice I've given you over the course of your life that has, good or bad, that's really stuck with you?
Piece of advice.
Good or bad. So it could be something that you rebelled against or something that has...
You're never going to be a contortionist.
Yeah, that's one. piece of advice, work on your knee hyperextension. I regret that.
Doing it or not doing it?
Doing it. Because yeah. My knees hurt, man.
Now you just have bad knees.
No, I just have bad knees. I mean, my hyperextension is better, but it hurts like a motherfucker.
Okay, well, there you go. There's, take that, throw so, you out there with
accept
knees.
Your body pretty much as it is would be my piece of advice for up-and-coming circus artists.
That's good. And then as far as it could be a book or a movie or a TV show or a theater piece that you've seen that somebody who is getting into circus for the first time or the early part of their development as a circus person, would you recommend they watch, read, or experience?
Discipline and Punish by Michel Foucault. No, I mean, I think it depends. That's a kind of, can you rephrase the question?
Yeah, so what is an important thing that somebody who is getting into circus read, watch, or see that was important to you or that you think is worth people spend the time engaging with?
Well, I think that goes back to our earlier discussion about different kinds of circus work and different kinds of circus artists. If I was talking to someone who wanted to be an artist in the capital A sense of the word, I actually would say Discipline and Punish by Michel Foucault, which is a book about discipline and the role that discipline has in society. And the way that we internalize discipline and experience the desires of other people as our own desires. So like the desire of the spectator to see something fantastic as my desire to do something fantastic. And the amount of sort of like pain that we put ourselves through in order to deliver on those desires. Because I think that's a thing that's like not often, that circus artists often take for granted, that you have to discipline yourself. And I think that we do so much of that already in society. Like everyone is like, you know, like I set my alarm clock and I get up and I do my thing and I go for a jog. And like, you know, you internalize all of these commands. And the fact that circus does that like 100 to 200 to 500% more than everyone else, I think that as an artist, that's something to deal with, you know. So that's one thing. I would also recommend, if you can get your hands on a copy of Au Cirque, which is a circus piece from Alma Buholzer and Thomas Holgrin that premiered last year. It's a circus piece that I would say is like about circus. And I think it's an interesting approach.
How do you spell the name of it?
O-R, like or, and Cirque, like Cirque du Soleil.
Awesome.
But you probably should just, I mean, I guess I would just email them. So, because I don't know, I don't think it's online or anywhere, but I'm sure that if you emailed them, they would be happy to share with you. So it's Alma Buholzer, B-U-H-O-L-Z-E-R, and Thomas Solgrin, S-A-U-L-G-R-A-I-N. And their circus company is called Circus Fetus.
Was your a circus fetus?
Circus fetus.
Is that their actual name, or is that like the American or the English?
No, it's actually called circus fetus.
I like that. Okay.
Yeah, so I would recommend that one.
We should do call our circus baby.
Circus baby.
Although I guess a fetus implies that it's not even born yet. So
yeah, yeah.
That's cool.
This is getting off the rails.
Yeah, right. They're just getting off the rails.
Last question. Yeah. Who do you think we should have on our podcast that we haven't had on?
Bauke, for sure. Mm-hmm. Like, I think that would be super interesting to talk with her. Who else? And I would talk to Alma and Tom, these two artists I just talked about.
The circus fetuses.
The fetuses, yeah. Alma's interesting. Alma's actually at the moment doing a master's in psychoanalysis and culture as a kind of like a complement to her performance work. Cool. So she's got a really, really interesting perspective and like a totally different theoretical perspective than what I'm getting. But I think an interesting person to talk to for sure. Yeah.
Awesome. Seb, thank you so much for coming on the podcast.
Anytime. And
sharing your ideas.
Anytime. And if anyone wants to write me with comments, I'm also interested to hear what people have to say around the world.
Yeah, how do they reach you if they want to keep the discussion going?
Facebook is fine. Seb can. Yeah, it'd be great. Like,
Lindsay was wrong, Seb. You're totally right about all of your arguments. Awesome. Yay.
Thanks, guys.
That was our interview with Sebastian Kahn.
If you liked that and you like our podcast, make sure to like us on Facebook, follow us on Instagram, Twitter tweet us, email us at hello@highwaycircus.com, and subscribe on iTunes and rate us.
Have a great week.
Have a good week, guys.
And make sure to follow our Instagram story for awesome.
And make sure to follow our Instagram.
She's so mean.